This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News, host Bob Edwards talks with Nobel Prize winner Jimmy Carter. The former president says he's concerned that the Bush administration does not have enough international support for its policies in Iraq and North Korea.
The diplomatic effort has not been adequate. The public opinion polls almost throughout the world show that America has not yet prevailed in convincing other countries that our policies are correct.
You can hear the full interview with former President Jimmy Carter tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News. Right now, we turn to the latest news in the conflict over Iraq. The United States, Great Britain, and Spain are expected this afternoon to release a new resolution on Iraq to the UN Security Council. Joining me by phone from Westchester County, New York, is Michael Elliott. He's editor-at-large and a columnist with Time Magazine. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Elliott.
My pleasure.
If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. And our email address is totn@npr.org. First of all, Michael, what should we expect from this latest resolution?
I think it'll be a pretty simple resolution. I think it'll restate or at least recall the terms of Resolution 1441, which was passed unanimously by the Security Council last November. It will then recall, as 1441 said, that Iraq was being given a last chance to comply with Security Council resolutions on disarmament. It will conclude that it has not taken that last chance, and it will recall that 1441 specified that serious consequences would follow from Iraq's refusal. I think that's all that it is intended to do and all that it needs to do. It essentially needs to remind the other members of the Security Council what they themselves said last year.
Is it possible that there would be any more definition of what is meant by serious consequences, that it would get more specific about that?
I don't think it needs to. I think everyone understands that serious consequences mean that if Iraq doesn't disarm voluntarily, Iraq will have to be disarmed involuntarily. I don't think there's anything to be gained by the three sponsors of this resolution going into greater detail there. I don't think anyone expects them to.
And is it likely there's going to be a timeline for action in this new resolution?
I very much doubt it. The British have said on a number of occasions that they imagine that the discussions on this resolution will take about 2 weeks. If there's one thing that we've learned about Iraq in the last 18 months, it is that at any time T, the expected resolution of the crisis is twice the expected period of time. So I'd say that we'll probably be talking about this resolution for 3 weeks rather than two.
Mm-hmm.
I think the resolution will either be put to a vote or it'll be plain that it's not worth putting it to a vote at some point in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Now, there's also been some mention of a counter-proposal.
But that wouldn't be a resolution. The French and the Germans, and evidently the Russians as well, have said that they see no need for another resolution. The French, thereby adopting, ironically, the position that the hardliners in the Bush administration were taking up until 2 weeks ago. Let's not suppose that the French are any more consistent in these matters than anyone else. The French have said that they don't see any need for a resolution. What they and the Germans, and apparently joined today by the Russians, have said is that they will make some proposals for enhancing and deepening and sharpening and widening and any other gerund that you want the inspection process.
Mm. France has been especially vocal in its stance against military action in Iraq. Can you envision anything that would change France's mind on
this?
Oh,
absolutely. I mean, France has been explicit that it has not ruled out military action in all circumstances. I mean, they've said that with the possible exception of what I think was a misstatement by President Chirac in January, when he shared a rather kind of emotional celebration of the Elysee Treaty with Chancellor Schroeder of Germany. But with the exception of that occasion, the French have gone out of their way to say that they do not exclude military action. And in his interview with Time 2 weeks ago, 10 days ago, President Chirac made it absolutely plain that if the inspectors at any point say that they really can't do their job, then France, in effect, would have no choice and would say, well, of course, we now understand that disarmament has got to be done by military action. So the French line has never been a military action in no circumstances line, nor has the Russian line. The French line and the German lines are different in that respect because the Germans have said more often that they see no need for military action in any circumstances. However, exactly a week ago, the Germans signed a EU statement of common foreign policy, which was predicated on the assumption that military action might be justified in some circumstances. So the Germans, too, have shifted off that absolutist position.
Now, late last week, UN Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix demanded that Iraq start destroying a large number of its missiles by March 1st. Iraq does not seem to be leaping forward to do that. How is that going to affect everything that's going on now?
Well, I think that would be a very foolish thing for Iraq to do. Blix's letter is absolutely specific. I mean, it's really very well, for those who kind of don't understand the way in which diplomacy works, it's well worth kind of getting hold of Blix's letter. It's available on many websites. You can kind of see the whole thing. I think he sets out, from recollection, I was looking at it earlier today, I think it's 9 separate paragraphs that he sets out of things that Iraq has to start doing by March the 1st, which is next Saturday. Now, if Iraq is serious about disarming, there's no argument about the terms in this letter. It's not fuzzy. It's not vague. It's not open to more than one interpretation. It's an extremely precise set of requirements that Blix is placing upon the Iraqis, and if they're serious about disarmament, then they can start doing all 9. In fact, they don't have to wait till Saturday. They can start doing it today, which I would have thought convince a lot of people that they were genuinely serious about disarmament. And if they don't start doing it today, or if they start dragging it out, if they start arguing about the terms of Blix's letter, then I suppose people will draw their own conclusions on whether the Iraqis are serious or not.
Well, let's see if we can get a call here. Marie in Philadelphia. Hi. Marie, you're
Hi.
On Talk of the Nation. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. This might sound like a real silly question, but it just occurred to me. If we have UN inspectors in there now, and they are unable to find weapons, and we say that they must disarm or we are going to disarm them forcibly, and they can't find any weapons, what are we going to disarm?
Well, it's a very good question. The assumption, of course, is that our assumption, or the administration's assumption, is that there are weapons, that they're hidden, that plenty of people know where they're hidden, that those people are not saying where they're hidden, and that after a regime change in Iraq, it would be relatively easy. It wouldn't take 2 days, it would take some time, but it would be relatively easy because people would talk and because papers would be available to find out where the weapons were hidden.
So we're making 2 assumptions then. We are assuming that we are going to depose Saddam, and we are assuming that the people of Iraq who are in positions to make decisions are going to cooperate with us. Am I correct?
Well, I mean, I think there's lots and lots of people who can help on where the weapons are who would not be prepared to help for very good reasons in present circumstances. I mean, it would be easier to find out where the weapons are in what you might call a more permissive environment than exists now.
I understand.
Thanks so much for your call, Marie.
Thank you.
Now, also with regard to the weapons inspections, Hans Blix is expected to present his latest report to the UN later this week. What might be in that report?
Well, that's actually, one has to be kind of boringly precise about what that report is, just so that people kind of, you know, don't get off on the wrong foot. UNMOVIC, which is the United Nations monitoring organization that Hans Blix heads, has been in existence since 1999, although it actually hasn't had anything to do in Iraq until the last 2 months. Under the Security Council resolutions that set UNMOVIC up 4 years ago, UNMOVIC had to do a quarterly report on its work at the beginning of each quarter. Well, actually not at the beginning of each quarter. The March the 1st report is a regular quarterly report of UNMOVIC. It isn't necessarily anything that goes into detail about what UNMIVIC has done in Iraq in the 2 weeks since the St. Valentine's Day report. So, you know, you can expect that in the March the 1st report, there will be lots of, well, we now employ X number of people, and we used to employ X number of people, and we've got an office here, and we used to have an office there. In other words, you know, one shouldn't necessarily assume that just because there is a report on March the 1st, it's going to be high drama. This is a regular quarterly report. At the same time, Blix, or for that matter, Blix can volunteer a report anytime he likes on what he's found in Iraq, and members of the Security Council can ask for a report at any time he likes. So I can see already that we're getting off on the wrong foot this week in some of the media coverage this week, with everyone kind of getting hysterical about this March the 1st report as if this was some kind of great big deal. The March the 1st report is a strictly regular quarterly report. It may or may not have dramatic stuff in it, but it would have happened whether or not inspectors were in Iraq.
Michael Elliott is a columnist and editor-at-large for Time magazine, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Robert in Beverly Hills, California. Hi, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, hello.
Go ahead.
I was just wondering if there was something a little strange about our position demanding that Iraq disarm at the same time we're threatening to attack them. I mean, it's comparable to giving a man a beating and telling him to keep his hands at his sides.
Well, it is. I mean, you actually raise a very interesting point, because one of the difficulties about what we're saying to Iraq now is that I'm going to kind of, you know, take your comment and kind of move it on a little bit, is that we have removed any incentive for, or it is arguable that we have removed incentive for good behavior, because, say, if Saddam Hussein may think that what, no matter what he does, it is the intention of at least some people in the United States to have him deposed from his regime. And if he feels that he can't win, he kind of get into kind of rather complicated strategic game theory, then arguably you have removed an incentive on him to behave. So, you know, one has to kind of play these sort of strategic games rather carefully, and there are certainly some people who would say that we have not done that, that we have removed an incentive on Saddam to behave and disarm.
Okay, thanks so much for your call, Robert. Let's just turn to Turkey now for a moment. How close is Turkey to a deal that would allow U.S. combat troops on
Turkey? I think that's pretty much a done deal. I think that'll go to the Turkish parliament imminently, possibly, I mean, certainly in the next hours and days. And I think it will go through the Turkish parliament, and U.S. troops will be based in northeastern Turkey, as they want. The Turks have done a good job of bargaining, as they often do, and I slightly take my hat off to them, actually, because they realized that they had a strong hand and they played it rather well, I think.
And just to get back to that resolution we were talking about at the beginning of the program, remind us what has to happen for a new resolution to pass.
New resolution needs 9 votes in favor without a veto against. There are 5 possible vetoing powers, of course, United States, United Kingdom, neither of which obviously will veto. France, Russia, and China. France has not vetoed a UN resolution since 1956. It would be truly extraordinary if it was to veto a resolution backed by the United States, which is the world's largest superpower, and for that matter, Japan's oldest ally, and the United Kingdom, which is an ally of France and the European Union, and which is co-sponsored by Spain, which is another European Union country. So if France was to veto this, you know, this would be a moment of remarkable history. It's not been done for nearly 50 years, which is one reason that I place a small bet that it doesn't happen this year either.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Michael.
Okay.
Michael Elliott is a columnist and editor-at-large for Time magazine. He was on the phone from Westchester County, New York. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington.